Hello and welcome to Sounds Good, the podcast towards a more sustainable lifestyle. Our names are Tui and
Max.
As our title, In the Mood for Good Food. This week's topic is sustainable food consumption and how local community like our today partner, our interviewer, can help to start a change in our society. But later more to this topic.
First, we would like to talk a little bit more about the topic of sustainable nutrition. It is now undisputed that climate change is having a massive impact on the unique ecosystem in which we live. Consequences include the accumulation of extreme weather events, the reduction of biodiversity, and other massive threats that affect our way of life today. Our diet plays an important role in this context. Food consumption is responsible for more than 60% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It is also estimated that between 50 and 80% of the world's resources are used to produce our food. This is according to the 2016 study, Environmental Impact Assessment of Household Consumption by Diana Ivanova and her team. From this point of view, it is becoming increasingly important to make our behavior regarding our food more environmentally friendly. This is especially true for us in the countries of the global north. We are one of the main causes of this resource consumption and must start to change our food consumption in order to achieve sustainable development goals defined by the UN.
So what is an environmentally sound food? Is it already defined in the 1994 by the Oslo Roundtable of Sustainable Production and Consumption? According to this one, food is considered as environmentally sound if it is satisfies the basic needs and provides a better quality of life while minimizing the consumption of natural resources, toxic material, and emissions of waste and pollutants during its life cycle, so as not to compromise the needs of future generations. Specific examples of what more environmentally friendly food consumption can look like include increasing the consumption of plant-based food or decreasing the consumption of animal-based food, targeting seasonality and increasing the use of locally produced food also plays an important role on the consumer side. Opposite to the behavior of the consumer, it is the role of the producer. The ways a food is produced has a massive influence on its impact on the environment. As a rule, it can be said that organically produced food is ecologically more sustainable. What this means is regulated by the European Union. According to the European Regulation number 209291, no genetic modification may be made to organic produced food. Furthermore, the use of chemical pesticides and fertilizers is prohibited. In case of animal food, there are a strict regulation regarding the welfare of the animals and the feedstock used.
And although most consumers are aware of the problems and there is a basic understanding of their sustainable food consumption, there is still a big gap between the consumer's attitude and their actual consumption behavior, as shown among others by Vermeer and Verbeek, 2016, or Van Damme and Van Trip, 2013, in their studies. Therefore, we want to give more attention to this topic today by emphasizing the importance of the topic even more and by giving you tips on how to start making your food consumption more sustainable.
So here today, 18th of February, we are going to discuss with our inspiring guests from a worldwide grassroots organization. This successful organization was founded in 1989. It is now today involved more than millions of people from over 160 countries and is constantly fight for a better future concerning our food choices. Since we are in Finland and our guest is currently in Portugal, we are going to conduct this podcast via Teams. Our listener are probably already wondering who we are going to interview here. So, hey, could you please explain us who you are and which organization you are presenting?
Hi. I'm my name's Will LaFleur. I represent Slow Food Helsinki. It's Slow Food International Slow Food is an international organization based in Italy, but now with branches in a majority of countries of the world, I would say. And I'm the chair of Slow Food Helsinki.
And this is Minae Tani. I am also a member of Slow Food Helsinki, and this year I'm on the board as well.
Right.
So can you introduce us about Slow Food Network, like what are the purpose and goal of Slow Food?
So Slow Food started in the late 1980s as Rome as a kind of protest against the building of a McDonald's in front of the Vatican. So Slow Food is almost quite literally a sort of way to protest the increasing of fast food, so which is represented, you know, in a major way by McDonald's, but it's a bit deeper than just opposing the term fast food. So you could say the kind of slogan for Slow Food is good, clean and fair food, and for the kind of meaning of this, good is to indicate food that tastes good, food that's pleasurable, and they make a really kind of emphasis on the idea of pleasure in food and how it should be a pleasure, especially in let's say Europe and North America. Pleasure has been really sort of something as a bad thing, that you're not supposed to have and enjoy food. You're not supposed to take pleasure from it. It should be really kind of bare and it comes from, you know, a kind of Christian heritage. And so this idea of good is to really to see food as something that's really, really enjoyable, that you share with people, that is of high quality. So it's good. Good clean is so that it's grown in clean, in a environmentally conscious way, without the use of pesticides, without destroying the environment, and that it comes to your plate and is healthy for you. Then fair is that it's produced in a way which is fair for the farmer. The farmer is given a fair price and due value for the food, and the consumer pays a fair price. So something that is, you know, not so cheap, because the farmer and the people who produce the food need to earn money, but something that's also not outrageously expensive either. So this would be the sort of core of Slow Food. And from the 1980s, it's grown into a multi-million member network around the globe. Yeah.
It's really cool to hear that. But like, you have a goal, and can you tell us a little bit, how did you have, like, what did you do to achieve that goals? Like, what are the activity now with Slow Food at the moment?
So now, for our local chapter in Helsinki, what we we mainly try to do is organize interest, organize people, and try to create interest in local kind of, let's say, food products. So that would include in Helsinki, we organize foraging workshops with a local expert and guide who will take a group of us out into the forest to forage wild herbs, which could be for eating, possibly for medicine, to kind of learn what is available, you know, really immediately. Also with mushrooms, we might then at the end of that workshop do a cooking, we might go cook the mushrooms that we've picked, or using some of the herbs to make salads or something like this.
Tea.
Then we might have a cooking, cooking workshops. We might go meet at a local restaurant that's sourcing their food from local farmers and doing it in a really nice way. And so as a way to get together and meet over food and drink. Last year we had a beer tasting from, what was the Nola in which is a zero waste restaurant in Helsinki. What else kind of things do we do?
No, now? I think these are the main area of activities we do. And we, of course, through our social media, we share news, food-related news, sustainability-related news, so that people with a likely mindset get the information as well. I think what we do is many participants to our events are with the international origin. They are mainly expats. There are some Finnish people come in as well, but there are mainly international audience we have. And it's very important for them coming to Finland, like, to find out where to get the locally sourced food for everyday eating and just to learn the environment and nature around it. And it's really informative that there are actually so many edible things growing, because living in Helsinki as a capital city, it's a city that's really close to nature. So learning about nature and surrounding where we live is really important for everyone.
And I'll just finish by adding that one of the really important things that Slow Food does internationally and that we do here in Helsinki is to try to promote particular producers who are producing, let's say, in really ecologically mindful ways, and especially traditional ways. So Slow Food is really interested in highlighting traditional food practices, whether it's in Italy, whether it's making cheeses in the traditional ways or salamis, or whether it's different, like biodiversity. So producers who are growing like old varieties of tomatoes or this kind of stuff. And in Finland, for example, there are a few cattle producers who are raising the indigenous cattle breeds of Finland, of which there are only there's one, for one example, the Eastern Finn cattle. There are only about 900 left, but it's a really important species because it's the only species which can maintain the meadowland biodiversity in certain areas of Finland. Other breeds of cow can't do it. So it's really important to keep these kinds of cattle alive. And one way to do that is to support the producers who are maintaining these herds. And for example, we personally buy beef occasionally from these particular from this particular producer because of their practices. So these are the kind of things that we're also trying to share with our network here in Helsinki.
What do you think is the current state of the food consumption in Helsinki?
Maybe Mina is a better person to start answering.
Yes. So again, like, this is a perspective of expats living in Finland. When I first came to Finland, my first impression is, okay, there is a supermarket, you know, a few big chains, supermarkets everywhere. So it's accessible. The food is accessible. The supermarket is accessible for everyone. Every neighborhood has at least one or two small stores. So accessibility is really good. But then I soon started to realize that the supermarket carries many imported fresh products. And to me, it was really strange that most of the year they have this same kind of fresh products as far as the vegetables are concerned. I'm from Japan originally, and even in supermarket range, seasons are reflected in back home. So that was something that I find it really strange. Like, of course, climates are different from my home and Finland, but I just find, okay, Finland has four seasons. Why are there, you know, almost same products all year round? So I think that's when I started to wonder what is the local produce like? You know, is that different from what we get to see in supermarket? Where are finished produce? And then we discovered Reko Network, which is a grassroots movement where it's like a farmer's market, but set on a certain dates and days of the week, and they post the producers post availability on Facebook page, and the consumers can order in advance and then go and pick up the order on the market day.
Yeah, you can probably ask your teacher about it. I think she knows a lot about it.
Yes. Yeah. So until I find out about Reko, it was very hard for me. Okay, foods are accessible, but very hard to learn what grows locally, what's available each season. And I also didn't like the packaging of meat and fish products. They are, you know, hygienically packed, but, you know, vacuum packed or on a plastic tray. Accessibility is good, but the variety or the locality or the seasonality is kind of hard to access to if you don't have the information. So that's how I see it.
Mm. Yeah. A follow-up question to this. Is there some way to follow the food consumption of citizens? Have you seen some kind of data that people have put out there that it would be easier to learn from previous mistakes or like become better at consuming food?
I can't say that there's like really concrete or that I've seen concrete numbers, but you know, you can, it's kind of clear that there are particular kinds of trends. So, for example, there's, this organization in Helsinki called Dodo, and they have a small greenhouse and they do, dinners where people come and they basically take care of food waste from the grocery store has expiring food, and Dodo takes that food and has a social gathering with people who cook together. So I can see that food waste, for example, is a big concern for people. I can also see that, like meat consumption is a big concern. So like the city of Helsinki has said that they're going to stop ordering beef for any of their events. Same with the University of Helsinki's, lunch. And I know a lot of my friends, are vegetarian or vegan. So there is this kind of awareness, which I would say from slow food perspective is also fine. But then, you know, it in some ways it can also be a bit extreme as well, because it also would say like the kind of special cattle that are being indigenous Finnish cattle that are being protected are also ignored or neglected in such a trend of veganism or vegetarianism, for example.
Yeah, and I have to say I didn't really like look through the data to get the trend, But I'm in kind of like a startup sort of scene, and there are many startup companies, like small companies, starting their business with the concern of sustainability or sustainable future, and they're trying to solve the problem to make future a better place. And these companies always take good data to explain their mission, explain their purposes and the product so that it fits to their purpose of solving the problem. So I can see that there are many data stored already about what it's called, footprint, carbon footprint. I can see there's accumulated data about like how different produce makes an environment impact in terms of land usage, water usage, things like that. But I think it's not really like available in a familiar everyday way as available information for impacting our decision making. And the other thing is consumer doesn't make decision only because you see the data. So that's there's another gap between data availability and how that impacts the decision making on everyday life. Mm. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, very well, yeah.
Yeah. So personally, how do you define the sustainability in the food context?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly because I've been following slow food for quite a long time, since I was quite young, probably since I was about 19 years old, when slow food was becoming a bigger organization in the US where I'm originally from. And so I think in a lot of ways I was influenced, my understanding of food sustainability was influenced by slow food, which is one reason why I'm kind of now part of a slow food chapter. So yeah, I mean, I would say one reason that I'm doing slow food is because my vision of sustainability aligns so in food aligns so well with what slow food talks about, which is food that's good, that has really strong flavor, strong taste, is really enjoyable. And something that I can feel good about putting in my body, and something that I can feel good about the people who were producing it were treated well, were paid fairly, et cetera. You know, as of course it's not always possible to know all of these things, but to kind of always be, mindful of this, this would be sort of my personal sustainability. If my ideal sustainability would be something that the most food production, not all, but most food production would be done for local markets rather than export markets. I think export markets and food is mostly a problem. Of course, trading has been going on between humans since humans have existed. So I'm not saying there shouldn't be any trading or exporting, but if food is mainly produced to export, then I think that's a big problem for sustainability.
Yeah, and yeah, I also agree with what you said, that slow food is a really good policy to introduce into your life. And I think the point is that it doesn't exclude the pleasure, as Will said in the beginning. I like the approach that the good, clean, fair food can be pleasurable and good for you, good for environment, good for people who makes it. And I think the protest, it goes on still. You know, it started as a protest against the globalization of food. And okay, now there is a change in trend, maybe less meat in fast food, but corporate, you know, this globalization is trying to take over and create a new market with a new product in the name of solving the problem of sustainability. So I'm not pointing to any particular names here, but I think what SoFood does in a way to look back our history and look back the food tradition and culture in different places really gives us a lot of learning and knowledge about how to keep eating with pleasure for the sustainable future. We don't have to change everything. We don't have to be so strict not to eat this, not to eat that. There should be a way that we have been doing. You know, what we think as our tradition is only a couple of decades, seven decades, maybe.
Or so, yeah.
So I think it's really important to see what we think as our tradition with the critical eyes and try to get the learning from longer scope on the history and our tradition and food culture. And slow food is a really good approach to learn about it and practice it in the classic old humane way, I would say.
What do you think are drivers for change within food consumption, and how do you keep the motivation among the network? Does the drivers come from governments or regulation, legislation, or social pressure?
I think I really feel strongly that the drivers come from, you know, food is an everyday practice. Everybody eats every day. And I think the drivers come from really, even for people who like, are really like to go on diets or want to do this and that with their food consumption, they still everybody knows that food can bring you a great deal of pleasure. And I think the one of the main drivers is in showing that food, that it's okay to take this enjoyment out of food and kind of framing food and eating together as a way of motivation, as a way of driving people to organize. I mean, when you describe, if Slow Food Helsinki wanted to do an event at a local restaurant, I might try to describe the dishes in a really, really enticing, in a really sexy way to get people excited about that. That's the kind of thing that I found which really motivates people to. So I think with food, it's rather easy, kind of, and it can be really simple. I think I see a lot of, like, in a lot of more top-down ways, it is really focused on data points, like, this is how much your carbon footprint is if you eat this and that and that. But I think okay, for some people, maybe that can work, but for at least for our community, it's really about connecting with each other, connecting with local, with the surrounding landscapes that in which we're living, and connecting with that, through being in forests, through eating food that come from forests and nearby farms. And this is the sort of motivation, I think. So in our case, it's quite easy, mm-hmm. I would say.
Yeah. For me, on a personal level, it's about finding others with a likely mindset. Because living every day and seeing where the market trends or food trend is going, I get depressed all the time. But finding others who's interested in similar things like nature, foraging, growing food by yourself, finding others who do that or who wants to do that to change the future is really important driving force for myself on a personal level. But at the same time, to make change faster and bigger, I think legislators and regulations and governments and these people who makes rule are really important. And I hope there is some movement going on about putting restriction on bad products for human health. But I think there should be more kind of motivation, what it's called, the scheme to encourage good practices, smaller scale but good practices, and there should be some sort of supporting structure or scheme to promote more of these food production method, for example.
It's really great to hear about that. Maybe I can come into another call, like how you educate other people. So what other stakeholders do you think about we should care about education and sustainable food consumption?
Maybe. Yeah, I think again, pleasure or fun is a key here. I think, you know, when you say, slow food doesn't want to say we are educating people, you know, like it's again, it's a top down approach. It's like school. And, if it's not, it doesn't sound fun, then people don't come to get educated. So it, more kind of warm and fun invitation. Is the necessary approach? I think.
Yeah, I would say from my view and my background in education, I would very much say that our education consists of, you know, going with the guide to learn about the. It's not called like a class. It would be called an event, right? But. And even going to, you know, I would consider tasting or trying a new kind of food or a product for the first time. That is a kind of education. Every time one of the members in our network tries something new, something that they haven't tried, a kind of mushroom, that is an education in itself. And this is, you know, that the taste of that mushroom is a type of knowledge, which is really important. And I think, of course, in a classical view of education, that's not really learning, but I very much disagree with that classical view. And I think that one of the powerful things of slow food is that people are learning, you know, at any time they're participating in events with us, they're learning about education. But to in a more sort of classical sense, slow food also organizes visits to local farmers who are, they'll talk about their practices of how they're growing things, how they're trying to support the soil, how they're supporting the biodiversity on their farm, how they're supporting the social, like how they're organizing, communities to support their work as in a community supported agriculture, for example. So these are also kind of maybe more along the classic sort of educational activities that are done, but I would consider everything, any event that Slow Food Helsinki is doing is educational, even if it's like a party.
What other stakeholders that are not involved actively at the moment should care about inviting people to sustainable food consumption? Is it like schools or other instances? Where does it start?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And again, as having a background in education, I have a very strong opinions about the role of schools in this. I think so. On one hand, okay, so University of Helsinki. University is a bit different, but in Finland is a really good example. Finland has, Finland offers free school meals for children. They have done since the post World War II era, which is, it's absolutely fantastic. But I do have a little bit of a feeling that they could do better as far as, what the quality of the food and the sourcing of the food that comes from that is sourced through schools. So I've experienced it myself in universities. I've seen what it is like in other institutions, education institutions, and And I know it's a huge expense. It's very expensive. And I would say that it's, food, you know, it doesn't matter how expensive it is. That it's the most important thing. And it has, because if you start from food, food intersects basically every other issue. It intersects issues of transportation, emissions. It intersects issues of fair work. I mean, if institutions are buying really cheap food, that probably means that there's a good chance that food is being grown and produced in ecologically destructive ways, possibly using exploitative labor or imported labor. So it's cheap labor. So there are plenty of issues with getting cheap food. So I think it's really important that public institutions, schools in particular, if they would be a sort of ground zero for pushing a drive toward local sourcing, you know, also of course schools having gardens, so that not gardens just to garden, but gardens that where kids are actually growing food, which they then cook and eat with each other. I mean, let's bring it a full circle. You know, you could run a whole school based on a garden. You could have chemistry lessons based on the garden. You could have history lessons based on the garden. You could have astronomy lessons. You could run your entire school starting from a garden and go from there. So I think schools are extraordinarily important, but institutions that provide food are really, for me, they're a really important place to start, because there's a possibility and also I think a responsibility, by especially public institutions to kind of lead in this way, and create, you know, demonstrate pathways for others, to follow.
I don't have particularly like I can't name anything particular, but I think I don't know who does this, but I think it's equally important that adult gets re-educated, or you know, the place to learn.
Send them to a re-education.
I mean, okay, maybe Slow Food is the organization who's kind of providing that learning opportunity. One of the groups, but what I've seen is that Finland has really nice nature education. How to treat, forest, what not to take, things like that.
Or just being in the forest and exploring it.
Yeah,
as a child, bird
watching, where many people going into it. Maybe it would be really nice to have more stakeholders who can connect that with the food aspect. I know there are people who's fishing, there are hunters around there. And there's nature education. Maybe that if those things are like come along and work together as a learning place, it would be more interesting because they're not separated, and it would be really great opportunity equally for kids and adults to learn about food and sustainability as in like all connected circle.
So there's absolutely a lot of possibility and opportunity to involve more people into Slow Food.
Yeah.
So how do you see about the future? Like
future is now, man. It's a good question. I have a high, or let's say strong hope that the power of bringing more people into this way of thinking about food and seeing food is it's quite powerful. Sort of a really powerful way to do it is to make it enjoyable. And I think like the future of the organization, I think, is very, very much depends on the involvement of people, of making connections, social connections with each other, of connecting with the places where we live. And the continued practice of this, I think, is, you know, as unexciting as it sounds, this is the future, to continue to not make it a special thing that you do every once in a while, but to make it to sort of get it to the point where it's an everyday way of thinking or an everyday kind of practice. And I think that's the sort of, maybe that's the sort of challenge that slow food has going into the future. Yeah.
I am personally very pessimistic person, and as I said, I get depressed just, you know, looking around what's going on in our world. So I can't say at the moment the future is bright. If we continue on, future is not bright, unfortunately. But we can change. And one thing that I'm hanging on to stay sane is that the future is a consequence of the choices that we make today, now. So hanging on to that word and just do what I can do, what we can do. And slow food is, again, a great approach to invite more people to share pleasure and knowledge and culture that contains a lot of useful information that we can take from our history that we can carry on to the future. So, yeah, future won't be bright unless we are connected and do this together.
Yeah, so we'll have to definitely engage and teamwork.
Yeah,
is or makes the dream work.
Mm.
Yeah,
and what about I recently read somewhere that the global food demand is expected to rise, and because of that, so we also have to become more innovative and come with more efficient foods, and then I remember that. There was some news about people starting to eat insects. Do you think that is something that people are going to do in the future? What are some potential challenges in that? It is clear that it has a lot of nutrition, protein, et cetera. But what does this? What kind of thoughts does this bring out in you?
Well, there are a couple things. One is, yeah, I mean. Insects are already eaten in many places around the world. Mm. I've eaten insects plenty of times. And I think one of the problems with eating insects is fine, and yeah, they are nutritious, and perhaps we can see them as a food source as well, but I think one of the problems with the way that insects are talked about is, yeah, like in the article that you mentioned, if you know, the demand, food demand is rising, because the population is rising, but one of the problems with our current system is that most of the food, the most destructive or ecologically destructive parts of the industrial food chain are not growing things for consumption. They're not growing food for eating. They're growing products for feeding animals and for fuel. So if there's a map I saw the other day of a map of the world in different colors. Green areas were areas of the world that are growing primarily food, and then purple areas were growing primarily for feed and fuel. And all of North America and part of Brazil and Argentina and all of Europe were completely purple. That means that these are the most industrialized agriculture places in the world. And that means they're mostly growing things for fuel. They're not growing food. So they're not feeding people. And all of Africa, most of the rest of South America, all of South Asia, China, East Asia is all green. That means that most of the food, most of the agriculture in these areas, some areas of China are an exception. Most of the agriculture in these areas are grown for local food consumption. And there's a group, they're called the ETC group. They're kind of oversight group for agricultural technology. Since 2009, in multiple reports, they've shown that actually the what's called the peasant food web, which is farms under 5 hectares or less, as well as fishermen, fishers and hunters, hunters and gatherers as well. This what's called the peasant food web actually produces 70% of the food that the world actually eats, on only 12% of the agricultural land. So if you think about that for a second, 12% of the land under agricultural use is feeding already 70% of the people in the world. Now, the industrial food chain, on the other hand, feeds around 25 to 30% of the world on 80% of the agriculture, or over 80% of the agricultural land use. And that industrial food chain also produces 85 to 90% of the emissions produced by agriculture. So all of a sudden, this idea that we need to feed the world because of the growing population, when we look at these numbers, what we actually see is that it's very possible to feed the number of people in the world on not very much land. So the problem then becomes, how is land used? What is the land being used for, and what are the ways in which it's used? And I think for me, this is the key problem, because the right now, land use, agricultural land use in Europe and North America is extraordinarily inefficient. And it's inefficient not because it's inefficient in terms of feeding people. It's very efficient for large firms and large organizations making lots of money and producing things that make lots of money. It's very efficient in that regard, but it's not efficient at feeding people. Also, small farms under 5 hectares contain much more agricultural biodiversity than compared to larger farms. And the biodiversity is important for several reasons. We all know that there's biodiversity crisis, but also there's, you know, biodiversity is correlated with soils being able to store more carbon. So it also has connections with greenhouse gas emissions. You know, it's not, biodiversity and greenhouse gas emissions can't really be separated, even though if we do so analytically. So I think then the question of insects becomes like kind of void. Like, yeah, we should eat, like, insects are fine, and there are many places in the world, you know, which are not in North America or Europe, which have been eating insects for a long time and still continue to do so. I think it would be great to learn about some of those traditions and possibly bring that into our own. But I think the idea that we need to feed the world because the population is growing, so we need to figure out new innovations for doing that. Now, the innovation that we need to find out is how to use our land better, and how to grow much more food for people to eat, on small amounts on the land that we do have. I think there's no need for new technological innovation. There's only need for reorganizing the way that land is used in agriculture.
Yeah, I think added to that, I would say innovation doesn't have to be new, shiny, data tech, or looking at growing new kinds of food. Again, I think looking back our food culture and tradition and knowledge, there are so many things that we can use to, let's say, improve the shelf life of food that we are probably now wasting. So from my point of view, innovation is needed in distribution of food and preservation of food. And in terms of preservation, we have lots of old knowledge that can help. And some people started to do it during the pandemic. I can see making their own kraut, the fermented vegetables and all that. And fermentation is kind of making a micro trend here and there. So I think revisiting this old skill of preserving food is one innovation. From today's perspective. And I really appreciate this is a tech innovation, but I really appreciate the tech innovation of visualizing where the food is wasted and where we have a distribution problem. So I'm hoping that these innovations can be used for a better sharing of food we produce today. Mm. I think cutting down the food waste can really help feeding the world, because we are wasting so much.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about, instead of thinking about it in terms of food waste, think about it in terms of food surplus. So the idea that actually we produce way more food than we produce. I think I saw some statistic that, currently the world produces 3 times more food than there are, like, to feed people the whole world 3 times over. But most of that food is clearly not getting to people. So it's an access and distribution issue as well. So I was reading an article that was talking about thinking of food waste rather in terms of food surplus to kind of imply the idea that there's plenty of food, but it's not distributed and organized in an efficient way.
Yeah. And then lastly, again, this is an innovative approach that we kind of started to take. We are having a lifestyle that requires less and less body exercise in modern life. So looking at the diet and rethink, do we need to eat 3 times a day? For example, I mean, I wouldn't recommend this for kids, but for adults, we are having obesity issues. So maybe cutting down one meal from everyday eating, or we are doing once a week, like no dinner day, for example, and adults are just fine. So, okay, maybe global north, eating less can probably feed more people in the rest of the world. So innovation can be technological, new, modern thing, but it can also be a personal level, and it can also be old and classic, nothing special, but just a practice, new practice that we don't do it nowadays.
Yeah, okay. So this podcast is soon coming to its end.
Yeah.
Before let you go, we have a final question about. So what are some practical things that you think like any individual can do in order to create a cleaner path for their food they consume? And do you have any tips or advice for kind of like, here we have the Hankan student.
Join slow food.
Join your local slow food chapter. Find out if what kind of local farmers or people who are growing food locally. You can find them in Reco. So find out who's growing food, what around you, what's growing food. Are there farms? Are the community supported farms that you can be part of? We are part of one where we purchase a share, and then with that share we have access to ordering their food boxes that are, you know, a couple times a month. We also give some of our time. So we'll go to the farm and help with some of the farming activities as a way of, you know, it's good to get up out of your desk and go out into the field. We help them harvest potatoes last year, and those potatoes then get distributed to all the members. It's a good way to socialize. So find community members who are doing these kinds of things in your local area. Reco is a great way to connect, but also organizations like Slow Food. You can find out what else is happening there. Mm. Even a simple Google search to discover these things is really important. So yeah.
And I would say you can start from going to supermarket and look at where food is coming from. You would be shocked how little you can find sourced locally. It's also helpful to look at the label of packaged food and see how much real food are actually contained in there. There are so many things that you don't recognize as the name of the food in the processed food. So just to learn about what you're eating every day is a really great start, I think.
Sounds great. All right. I think we have finished.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Appreciate it. Thanks a lot once again. Yeah, have a nice day.
Yeah, you too.
What a great interview. So this is it for this week, and we hope that you enjoyed listening, and we will tune in next week again. Big thanks goes out to our editors, Meretta and Hauk. Bye.
Bye.